Cindy, are you with us?
I am.
Great. Thank you for making yourself available. We're just reconvening, and I think before we get into the state forest item, we'll take up the consent agenda that we had, which included the meeting minutes from April 25th, the approval of the 2018 rangeland protection budget, and really the annual letters to the state foresters, which are more informational. But is there a motion to approve the consent agenda?
Move to approve.
Seconded.
Moved and seconded. Any discussion? And all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Motion carries. And now we'll move to the smoke management program permission for rulemaking, agenda item 3. This is an action item. So, welcome.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair. I'm Sen members of the board, State Forest Authority. For the record, my name is Doug Graff. I serve as Chief of Fire Protection for the Department of Forestry. Today before you is a decision topic, as the agency is requesting initiating rulemaking process for the smoke management program. In your packets today, you have a staff report summarizing the last 2 years of effort. If you may recall, joint meetings with the EQC and Board of Forestry starting November 2016, and then again November 2017. So this is your third, as a board, third installment of smoke management today. You also have within that packet the committee makeup, the roster of the committee that was utilized the review committee to conduct a 5-year review of the program, which brings us to today's agency's recommendations. And then finally, you have the proposed rules within your packet. Comprehensive review conducted. You'll see the strike through and the bold for new language consistent with rulemaking processes. Today's presentation really will be a brief overview of the program and the policy conversation to date, given that we have discussed this twice prior with the Board of Forestry. We review the committee's work to date, and then really spend our most time on the slide that highlights the agency's recommendation to move forward with rulemaking processes. To my left is Michael Orman from the Department of Environmental Quality, and we will tag team the presentation back and forth. So jump in, please, Michael, as you see fit along the way.
Will do.
The two legislative directives for the smoke management program are clear in law to improve the management of prescribed burning as a forest management and protection practice, and to minimize emissions from prescribed burning consistent with air quality objectives of the Federal Clean Air Act and State of Oregon Clean Air Act implementation plan developed by the Department of Environmental Quality. To ensure continuous improvement within that program management, the rule under the smoke management program advises a 5-year review, as discussed, of the smoke management program established jointly with DEQ and ODF to improve the implementation of the smoke management plan. Specific to authorities and roles and responsibilities between the agencies and the policy boards, the Board of Forestry reviews and approves the smoke management plan and has authority for rule promulgation, and that's what we're here before today, requesting rule promulgation and initiate that process. ODF administers the smoke management program and manages and enforces the program compliance. The next slide will speak to the program, an overarching a summary of the program administration. Now I'll turn it over to Michael for some highlights on DEQ and DEQC.
So similar to the Board of Forestry, the Environmental Quality Commission reviews and approves the smoke management plan. We presented to the board or the Environmental Quality Commission in June the proposal that you're seeing today. With that plan, DEQ drafts a state implementation plan that is proposed to the Environmental Quality Commission for approval, and that plan includes the smoke management plan along with directives from the Department of Forestry. DEQ also has the role of monitoring air quality in our communities, and we have monitors set up throughout Oregon. We participate in the advisory committee that ODF runs for the smoke management plan, and we help develop and submit the SIPs.
I think critical in the process, and I'd highlight it, is alignment with the two policy boards, the Board of Forestry and the Environmental Quality Commission, is necessary to approve the plan by law, and we have initiated this process, recognizing that, with the joint meetings November 2016, November 2017. And in times and places in the past where the boards have not been aligned on certain topics, we have tabled a topic. Specifically, example is the PE study that was necessary in order to make a recommendation to advance increasing the polyethylene use on piles as an emissions reduction technique. And that occurred during the last recommendation through the five-year review. We tabled that until this review.
I should correct myself. It wasn't June where we were before the EQC. It was May last month.
Okay, high-level overview of smoke management implementation. You've seen this slide before. We've referred to it as the goalpost slide, and it also highlights the decision space. Important topic of the five-year review, which we'll spend the majority of our effort on, the decision space to adjust the smoke management program and rules to achieve the greatest balance between air quality and the ability to prescribe burn, essentially providing more opportunities for burning, mitigating the risk of wildfire that we've been seeing an increase in. This slide from the top right, the right goalpost that represents a sidebar on the decision space is a national ambient air quality standard. This is the only standard in terms of air quality from the EPA, Clean Air Act. And to the right of that goalpost is non-attainment. Communities reach non-attainment when they have three exceedances of the National Ambient Air Quality Standard, I'll refer to it as the NAAQS, within a three-year period. We do have a couple communities currently within non-attainment and a couple in maintenance areas across the state. To the left of that goalpost is no NAAQS exceedances. The left goalpost represents where the smoke management plan's policy sits currently, and the definition specifically that we'll spend our time on is on the intrusion, which is any ground level visible smoke within communities. The current standard threshold for an intrusion is no smoke within smoke sensitive receptor areas, which represent the majority of populated communities within Oregon. And to the right of that goalpost is an intrusion. I think important to the conversation is recognizing the effectiveness of hitting the target of avoiding intrusions, the effectiveness of the program to meet that standard. We, on a 10-year average, have over 3,000 ignitions across Oregon's landscape. That's starting a prescribed burn, and over the 10 years, we've been averaging 7, and when you add last couple years' data up to 8 intrusions a year. So of 3,000 ignitions, we've experienced 8 intrusions annually. So highly effective in terms of meeting the target that we set the standard for the program. As we consider policy trade-offs in terms of the decision space, it's important to understand the operations of the program. Currently, we have approximately 170,000 acres that we burn, 10-year average, within the state of Oregon. The program has authority over federal prescribed burning on forest land only within the jurisdiction of the agency, and on private lands prescribed burning, both pile burning, broadcast, and underburns. The acreage is split approximately half between public lands, federal lands and private lands. So in the 80,000 acres range that we see on private lands and on public lands burning. There is an interest annually on the 10-year average to burn approximately 270,000 acres. That's what's registered to the program to achieve land management goals. That's not achieved, so that expresses that there's some left on the table in terms of interest to prescribe burning. Those are what those numbers detail there. The policy trade-offs as we consider this very challenging issue is currently we burn wildfires in the state of Oregon approximately 500,000 acres annually across all the jurisdictions across the state. So as you increase prescribed burning, the science is clear, and any firefighter will tell you clearly changes our ability to suppress those fires. It changes fire behavior, allows us to get on the ground and produce containment lines to control those fires. We feel certainly with prescribed burning provides us a holding place and an anchor point to take aggressive suppression effort actions when we have units that are prescribed burn. So the intent would be reducing wildfire emissions and acres burned across the state with the use of prescribed burn. As you increase prescribed burning, you increase the potential for NAAQS violations and you increase smoke in the air that people breathe in and around our communities, which is the challenge and conversation that we ask the advisory committee to help us bring a recommendation to you, and we'll talk in detail there. So that's summarizes in general the smoke management program and the policy question at hand as we entered the conversation. Michael, anything to add?
The only thing that I would add is for the National Ambient Air Quality Standard, it's a 24-hour average. And it looks at 3 years worth of data, and it depends on how many data points DEQ collects on how many exceedances you're allowed. Just to point that out. Thank you.
The Smoke Management Review Committee, again, the five-year review, conducted from 17 through 18. We held five meetings. The roster is in your packet, a robust and diverse group of individuals to help advise the agencies with the recommendation. We met across the state, and we did have a field tour in Sisters to look at prescribed burning. We met in Roseburg, and we met in Salem. A very active committee, engaged and committed and dedicated group to challenge this, help us with this challenging issue. The primary recommendation from the agencies based on the advisory committee's work and the review committee is in and around the definition of intrusion. This slide details the components that we'll spend the majority of our time here remaining explaining the details on this recommendation. We're using the goalpost example again to identify, again, the right goalpost is the National Ambient Air Quality Exceedance. That's the right sidebar. Within this decision space, as I highlighted from the previous slide, we've adjusted the thresholds for intrusion. You recall the current definition is no intrusions, a zero tolerance essentially for smoke within the communities. We're looking at two thresholds for a smoke intrusion. One against the NAAQS standard at a 24-hour assessment, and it's a 25% buffer, if you will, against a NAAQS exceedance, National Ambient Air Quality Exceedance. And then the one-hour threshold, I'll allow Michael to highlight in detail there.
Sure. So the one-hour threshold that you see on the screen is marked at 70 micrograms per cubic meter. And the way that we got to the one-hour standard this time was to look at the AQI, the Air Quality Index, which is a tool that EPA uses to communicate health risks to the public. It takes science data and converts it into a standard communication method, a standard value that doesn't depend on the pollutant that it's looking at. It's just a standard scale that everybody kind of can have some reference to. Recently, EPA, or historically, EPA had both a one-hour standard and a 24-hour, one-hour threshold and a 24-hour threshold for the AQI. And that created some complexities with communicating health outcomes that we saw last year during the wildfire season. We may have a high impact that would cause some concern, but our 24-hour average, because it's looking back historically that past 23 hours, may show not health risk. And so it created some difficulties, and taking that into consideration, EPA created a new calculation that adjust the averaging time depending on the increase in value. And so it also gives you this better real-time analysis. And using that tool, the NOWCAST model, we were able to come up with this 70 micrograms per cubic meter, which is the shift from moderate to unhealthy for sensitive populations, which is also the shift from unhealthy to sensitive populations for the 35, which is our national ambient air quality standard. So we were trying to align both a 1 hour and a 24 hour based off this health outcome so that we can communicate effectively with the public and take a closer look at smoke intrusions in those areas.
So there isn't any margin on the 1 hour threshold. It's right up to the limit of transition to unhealthy to sensitive population.
In the model, it is. But when you look at what we would need in order to exceed the National Ambient Air Quality Standard, there is a buffer at the 70. So it's a trigger point for us to take a closer look. But it's not a 1 hour of 70 micrograms will not average out to exceed the NAAQS.
Thank you.
I think it's important for the board to hear what we learned from the committee review on this topic. And there's strong alignment from the committee review on the 24-hour stand threshold with a 75% buffer across all the interests in that group. And you can see a broad range of air quality health interests with the citizen at large, American Lung Association, County Public Health, Oregon Health Authority, Lane Air Protection Director. There was buy-in and comfort with moving the threshold with that 75% buffer from the committee. On the 1 hour, the air quality 1 hour threshold created, the 1 hour, the air quality interests were strong to hold that 1 hour in place. But for the, on the burning side, the land managers achieving goals on the landscape, universal that this will be restrictive to meeting their land management objectives. So there's definitely a divide in bringing that conversation to a unanimous decision for that recommendation. So the agencies have taken that counsel and advice and are presenting recommendation that we feel confident as presented could move through the EQC, Board of Forestry, up through the State Implementation Plan, approved through EPA, based on those conversations, balancing the law, which is balancing air quality and the opportunities to burn. I would highlight what does this mean in terms of intrusions that we've experienced in the past 10 years, to give you also some scope. When we look at 80 intrusions across the past 10 years, 80% of those will fall within a smoke incident area now. So we would see smoke into smoke-sensitive receptive areas, and 20% would now be defined as intrusions. So to give you some scope of how much was the window opened in terms of our 10-year average for intrusions? This represents approximately an 80% opening of a window. Between the two thresholds, the 1 hour is the most restrictive. Of those 80 intrusions, 16 of them would have met the 1 hour threshold to be an intrusion, but only 8 of them would have met the 24-hour standard. You see the difference between the two. The 24-hour average represents 90% of the window opening, 80% of the window opening when you add the 1 hour threshold to give you some scope and scale of those intrusions. That's a lot to absorb, so I'll linger on that for a moment.
Just one question on that, going back to your goalpost slide, and the significant backlog of acres that are planned and desired to be burned. To what extent does this design support or inhibit an expansion of a prescribed burning program? So, I mean, it was helpful, that so approximately 16 incidents over 10 years would have been a smoke intrusion now. So that's great. But what about a vastly expanded prescribed burning program?
And I think that's the unknown, to see how this shift will play out over time. It certainly opens opportunity for burning, shifting that window. But to the extent that we'll be able to utilize those opportunities depends on the landowner's engagements, grabbing those opportunities and burning. There's certainly an interest for more burning across the landscape, both on private and public lands.
So along those lines, Doug, so when you... I think it's 271,000 acres that were registered. Only, am I reading this right, 162 actual burned. We don't have data in terms of why they chose not to burn. Specifically, it's just the landowner chose not to burn.
Yeah, we did some of that work to articulate the whys. And the weather conditions certainly dictate that, and the windows of opportunity for the smoke management a good day to burn or a bad day to burn drives that. Administratively, the ability to get the resources on the table to achieve those goals certainly was a limiting factor. But there's a number of factors as right. to why. And then sometimes the window is pretty limited on a spring or a fall burning window. As we enter into fire season, things dry up pretty quickly or otherwise. But it's administratively and smoke management limitations due to the current rules for sure.
Yeah, it's just helpful. Maybe if you could do a look back if you understood why, but it doesn't sound like we have enough detail to the reasons to really be able to see if you overlaid this, what impact it would have had in the past on that.
The Forest Service was extensive, did an extensive look at why, what were the reasons behind those. And I don't have the percentages of where those at, but they may be able to speak to that.
So we do know how many we kind of stopped burning because of what the previous was. So there's some, we know that we would not stop 80% of them. Is that right? But that's hard to convert that into how much more accomplishment would you have got.
We don't
know yet until we implement it and play around with the implementation plan.
Just to mention, I think in terms of process here, we have several people who have signed up to appear. Continue with any questions you have now, but bear in mind that I'm sure that what we're going to hear will spark questions, and so we'll have Michael and Doug come back after that. Before we take action.
Good. I guess I'd ask this question and maybe we can come back to it too. One of the primary purposes to do prescribed burns is to create a more fire resilient landscape, right? So to hopefully dramatically reduce over time the amount of catastrophic wildfires. And so I'm curious, and we'll listen to the testimony too, but how it's different. I think a smoke management program is different if you're talking about what the trade-off is. And I don't want to get in trouble with the ag producers, but when I think of smoke management for grass seed farmers, for example, where there's no risk of that fire, I mean, that field burning and creating smoke in some future time frame, versus a landscape that we're talking about treating, and there's actually significant risk of that burning and causing an exceedance in a community. That's where this 1 hour thing, I do understand why many stakeholders are going, why would we create that restriction? So I'm going to be listening for that as we go forward. And I don't know whether you have a comment or not. I feel like if you can manage that, and yes, you're actually being more lenient, knowing that there are health concerns, but it's more in a controlled environment. Versus, I was in Bend during that, talk about a disaster, but that's uncontrolled, right? So do we lean more towards a lenient policy, knowing that we're actually controlling that environment and can take proactive measures to address potential health issues that would occur during that time? So
I think I'll let the group coming up next really evolve. The one comment I would offer is that concept is what brought American Lung Association to the table with this recommendation. And their willingness to participate in a comprehensive statewide public outreach campaign to talk about this issue statewide and say, we can back you in this. And this is why, because overall we see benefit in public health by reducing catastrophic wildfires and giving ourselves a chance to minimize the spread of fires, and on the public safety side of business, as we looked at Sisters, for example, in the Millie fire, where we were able to catch that on the west side of the fire, where we had treatments, including prescribed burn. Those conversations really helped the air quality interests, who frankly weren't there at the beginning of the conversation, come to support that type of recommendation, and folks can certainly expand on it, but it's a bigger than just looking at that.
Right.
Agreed.
Yeah. But it is kind of I think what gets us all into this conversation is that, you have unregulated smoke essentially, and
right,
regulated smoke, and finding the balance where hopefully the regulated smoke is going to reduce the unregulated.
Yeah.
Cindy, did you have any questions before we move to the public comment?
They have two more slides.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Just one.
Oh, I'm sorry.
One more.
So given the difficulty of participating by phone, I think I may hold my discussion and comments to the end.
That's fine. I'm wrong anyway. There's another slide.
Okay, so the update to the smoke intrusion, we spent the most time. That was the primary focus where we spent our energy. There are other rule adjustments. You can see those within the strike through in bold. I want to highlight a few others. We changed to a smoke incident as opposed to just an intrusion or no intrusion. We are going to put smoke into communities. We need to track that. We need to understand the impacts of that. We need to communicate that with communities. So we need to track it as a smoke incident. The smoke management plan objective language is adjusted to minimize smoke emissions and avoid intrusions, as opposed to the current language, which says prevent smoke from entering SRAs and no intrusions. So the question of what do you do when you have an intrusion? This is a learning opportunity for us. The one standard on the table is a NAAQS violation. That is the standard. These two are thresholds for the smoke management program to continue to learn and strive to achieve the greatest balance of air quality and land management interest in burning for all the reasons we mentioned. So I think the shift, it's nuanced in there, but a recognition that that is an opportunity for us to understand how to achieve those goals the best we can. And that language is there for that purpose. It establishes a standard in communication plans and public outreach and awareness. As we place more smoke in the air from prescribed burning, there needs to be a statewide outreach and local communication plans so people are aware of why we burn and where we're burning and when. And when we have intrusions, how long those are lasting, and really get engaged with communities. So there's acknowledgement that that's an important piece. I mentioned the polyethylene. That was an important part of one of your tours. That with the studies that were conducted, that's added in as the rule language change. We had language in the rules for necessity for prescribed burning. We added language in there for necessity of safeguarding public health. For consistency. And we've had special protection zones currently on the books within our directives. Those were added for clarity within the rule, but no changes in intent on those, but wanted to draw your attention there. And with that, we'll close with next steps process-wise. If approved through the board today to conduct a rulemaking process, that means the department and DEQ goes out for public hearings to present the rule changes, and then we would return to the Board of Forestry at the earliest in September with feedback from what we've learned from that public engagement process. DEQ has a similar consistent process as detailed there. Michael, did you want to highlight any components?
Sure. And I'll just call out that we also will be participating in ODF's concurrent public hearing process, and so we'll be present during those meetings to hear comment as well for the EQC. And then we'll be presenting to the EQC the finalized state implementation plan for approval and submittal to EPA for final review and inclusion in the state implementation plan.
Great. Thank you, and we'll see you back up here in just a few minutes. So the first two are Mark Stern and Steve Hawkins.
Good morning, all. Thanks for having me here. I'm Mark Stern with the Nature Conservancy. I lead our forest conservation program here in the state of Oregon. And I guess I want to start by acknowledging the hard work and good effort that the staff did here, Doug and Nick from the Department of Forestry, and Michael and his predecessor, David Collier from DEQ. And as they described, the Smoke Management Review Committee was an in-depth effort to try and sort of come up with a recommendations that we go forward in rulemaking here today, so I appreciate their efforts. As they highlighted, one of the areas of disagreement or lack of concurrence really focused around using the one-hour definition or the one-hour threshold as one of the criteria for determination of an intrusion or not. And just to clarify, I want to read from the EPA webpage one paragraph on how they describe, and this is a quote here, air quality index. So quote, by definition, the air quality index is calculated using from a 24-hour period. That's because the science we have about air pollution exposure and health is based on 24 hours, and therefore EPA's air quality standards are based on 24 hours. It is not valid to use shorter term, i.e. hourly data to calculate an AQI value. However, we want to report shorter-term data to caution people in time for them to reduce their exposure to the 24-hour exposure. And so I share that again, just saying that it is a challenging issue, but it's also when you go back and you look at the science and the data, there's a difference. There's some very clear guidance by the Federal Clean Air Act. And I guess I would say that the directive to the Oregon Department of Forestry there that was showed earlier was to be consistent with the Federal Clean Air Act And what I just read here was basically the directive and guidance under the Federal Clean Air Act in terms of air quality standards and adherence to it. As you may know, there's over 30 letters posted on the Oregon Department of Forestry webpage for smoke management, for the smoke management review process. That includes one from the regional forester, Jim Pena, one from John Stromberg, the mayor of Ashland. And in their letters, they specifically ask that the one-hour threshold not be included there. The other letters, which include letters from Deschutes County, Klamath County, Lake County, Harney County, the Eastern Oregon Association of Counties, Collins Pine, Ochoco Lumber, the City of Bend, the City of Redmond, the City of Sisters, the fire departments from each of those three cities, as well as Oregon State University, all ask and submit testimony saying we'd like to see the state follow the guidelines as consistent with the Federal Clean Air Act and the National Ambient Air Quality Standards, as we heard about earlier. A tough issue. So we also talk about wildfire smoke, and I would pause for a moment. I think we're all influenced by smoke that we've felt from wildfires over the past couple summers especially. Some of the data that was compiled by the Forest Service showed that from 2011 to 2016, there were 22,000 plus hours of degraded air quality in Oregon. Of that 22,000, 112 hours, or less than half of 1%, of those degraded air qualities came from prescribed fire. The point being, obviously, that's the regulated piece, but that regulated piece is a real small portion of the total impact that we're all feeling from the air quality issues here. So going forth today, I would ask the board consider in the rulemaking process of what we have submitted and shared with you is basically two alternatives, which are basically slight amendments to what the staff has committed. What I would describe as the preferred alternative is simply removal of the reference to the one-hour threshold, thereby being consistent with the Federal Clean Air Act guidance that's been provided. Or second, allowing for an exemption to those communities that have a very developed outreach and communication program that can notify vulnerable populations of potential pending air quality issues related to prescribed fire. I would add that a step like that would also be beneficial if it was implemented in terms of awareness and to wildland fire or other types of impaired air quality, be it from wood stoves or whatever. So briefly, those are the two recommendations I guess I wanted to offer to the department here and ask that that be considered for incorporation into the rulemaking that's going forward today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. Thank you for allowing me to speak this morning. My name is Steve Hawkins. This morning I'm speaking as the chair of the Blue Mountain chapter of the Oregon Prescribed Fire Council. I'm also the deputy fire staff and fuels program manager on the Bilal Whitman National Forest. Our group had met, and we definitely appreciate the effort that's been made to follow the national standards. We had commented 2 years ago on moving to something that was was a standard that we could adhere to, the national air quality standards being that, and so appreciate the effort made to use those standards and some of the wording changes within the plan itself on moving away from statements like prevent to minimize, and so we applaud those efforts. Likewise, as Mark has said, we also are concerned about the one-hour threshold, and put that in context for us here in Northeast Oregon. As we look at, we've had several intrusions over the last few years. Most of those would not, by the standards given, would not be an intrusion except for the one-hour mark. Probably 20% or 30% of those still would fall within that. Those intrusions or that exceedance of the one-hour standard are occurring at 2 o'clock in the morning because our smoke, most of our forests are above communities lie in valley bottoms, and typically is for an hour. And so what happens is the smoke pools and flows down into those communities during the middle of the night, and by the morning that smoke is dissipated and would not be an issue. We're concerned with the fact that we can't change topography, and smoke still flows downhill. We have not had in the last two or three years from the communities that have been impacted, we have not had a comment on smoke because it typically occurs in the middle of the night. It would be a question of whether those susceptible populations actually are even impacted at that time with most folks asleep indoors versus being during the middle of the day when folks are out working or soccer practice or whatever. So would question the need for the one-hour standard and or, as Mark pointed out, we definitely support that exemption, especially for those hard-to-burn acres that are within the WUI interface above towns. And those are really hard to meet on without some kind of an impact, albeit very short. Would ask that you consider that in the rule changes. And also based on the community involvement on how to address smoke within communities, our Blue Mountain chapter is part of the Northeast Oregon Cohesive Wildfire Strategy Group. It's representative of the counties in Northeast Oregon and Southeast Washington. And we talked with the emergency management coordinators from those counties last week, and they were fairly positive that we could set up a reverse call center for folks that would like to be contacted with that information so that we could be proactive in that. And we definitely are supportive of being able to do a better job of notifying folks of when smoke's going to be there, and would be committed to doing that if we'd be allowed to increase the burning. We have a very large need for increasing the scope and scale of burning within the Blue Mountain region, Northeast Oregon. We currently burn between probably about 20,000 acres a year, and without a lot of other changes, we could probably increase that or double that. And it's important to note that as we move forward in time, the amount of emissions produced from the amount of the acres we're burning is going to be reduced because a lot of those ecosystems require burning every less than 10 years. And that also meets the intent of that protecting high values at risk. And as we burn every 10 years, the smoke produced from an acre becomes less and less, up to 20, being 75% less than the first entry. And so we could burn more acres in the long term, but in the short term, we're going to have, there'll be some impacts. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next, we have our Pete Caliguri and Ed Key.
What you get, these handouts? Excuse me. Good morning, Chair Imason, State Forest Authority, members of the board. It's a real honor to be here. I'm today coming to you. My name is Pete Caligieri. I'm a forest ecologist with the Nature Conservancy, but I also provide science and technical support to the Deschutes Collaborative Forest Project based out of Bend and the Ochoco Forest Restoration Collaborative out of Prineville. And I'm one of a team of scientists working with the Nature Conservancy across the fire adapted forests of Southwest, Central, and Eastern Oregon with these collaborative groups that represent a diverse set of stakeholders from industry, environmental organizations, recreation, local government, the tribes, all of which support the increased use of prescribed fire. You've already alluded to some of the reasons why. So I approach this kind of wearing two hats, a professional hat as a forest ecologist, fire ecologist, and a personal as well. I say that I'm a fourth generation Oregonian, born and raised in Central Oregon, and I'm actually raising a fifth generation Oregonian right now. I have an 8-month-old daughter who was actually born, if you look at the handout second page, right at the tail end of that big blip of red air quality. My wife was in her third trimester during the Millie fire, and as Tom alluded to in Bend, it was pretty hard to be there at that point in time. So this is a very personal issue for me as well. The next page of that handout really points out the fact that this is the risk of wildfire is very real across Southwest, Central, and Eastern Oregon. The map is essentially the large fires that have occurred on the Sisters Ranger District alone since 2002, so the last 15 years. Over 50% of that district is burned, and you can see that if you're familiar with the area, the communities of Camp Sherman, Black Butte, Sisters, and its outlying subdivisions have essentially been ringed with fire. Some of those, like the Millie Fire, as Tom pointed out, were stopped on the east flank because of, I guess it was Doug pointed out that they was stopped on the east flank because of past fuels treatments and prescribed fire. So this is a very real risk that we're up against across this geography of our fire-adapted forests. It's not hypothetical. And those extreme wildfires pose a significant risk to forest resources, to local economies, to the communities and the firefighters' safety during those wildfires, as well as public health in the long term. So, in essence, this proposal is asking us to accept elevated, these one-hour thresholds to protect short-term public health by forcing all of us and future generations of Oregonians like my daughter to bear the longer-term risk of extreme wildfire and extreme smoke and the resources that it would affect. So in light of that, I think it's important to understand that the window is expanded, as Doug alluded to, and we're very appreciative of the alignment with the 24-hour standard because we think that that will expand the opportunities writ large. But to better understand it, you really need to unpack the remaining intrusions that are left. And Bend happens to be an example of a place where we've had a spare number of those intrusions that would remain even under the proposed rule. And the important thing to understand there is that that one-hour threshold becomes a significant constraining factor in achieving the highest priority prescribed burn units that protect communities, reduce their risk, reduce firefighter risk, and promote the forest resources that are the engine of our economy in the long term. That one-hour threshold would effectively prevent or constrain over 75% of our highest priority prescribed fire units. So of the remaining intrusions in Bend, 75% of those that would still qualify under the one-hour intrusion as a smoke intrusion are in that within a 10-mile buffer of the wildland-urban interface of Bend, meaning they would face the most significant constraints from this one-hour threshold. And I think that's particularly important to understand going forward because that one-hour threshold is not scientifically based. The 24-hour threshold, we believe, will adequately safeguard the public during those times. As Steve mentioned, the intrusions are occurring primarily during the middle of the night when people are inactive. And overall, they're causing a very small proportion of impacted or degraded air quality days, as Mark Stern pointed out. So I would ask that going forward that you really consider an alternative to the use of that one-hour standard in order to actually adequately take into consideration the risk trade-offs posed by wildfire and the need for us at a local, regional, and national level to achieve forest restoration goals that are set out in things like the Cohesive National Wildland Fire Strategy, the Collaborative Forest Landscape Restoration Act, and other local programs like Community Wildfire Protection Plan. To achieve this work in the highest, so we can invest those dollars that we have to do fuels reduction and prescribed fire in the highest priority areas around our communities.
Thank you.
Good morning. Thank you for the opportunity to comment. My name is Ed Keith. I work for Deschutes County as the county forester. In that role, I really focus on community preparedness in regards to wildfire. And I'll offer these comments not so much in relation to management of county lands, but in our collaboration and work with, especially with the Deschutes National Forest. In doing this fire preparedness work, we really are trying to achieve the three goals of the cohesive strategy, resilient landscapes, fire adapted communities, and providing for effective response. And this issue, I think, really lies at the intersection of all three of those legs of the stool of the cohesive strategy. And I believe that, you know, if we aren't successful in implementing prescribed fire on the landscape, we can't be successful with any of those. We aren't going to have an effective and safe response. Our communities aren't going to be successfully adapting to and learning to live with wildfire. And we aren't going to have a resilient landscape. Deschutes County commented on this or got involved in this process pretty early, actually right after the tail end of the last review process. So we've been waiting for a while, hoping that this process would move forward, and appreciate the movement that it has taken. We really came into it hoping to be able to see burning take place in strategic locations around our communities in a way that would protect our vulnerable populations, which, and by that I mean, you know, the entire community, the residents that live in them, our firefighters and visitors that come from all parts of the state and the country. And with that following, hoping to be able to follow the standards set forth in the National Clean Air Act. I'd submit that wildfire does pose, as the discussion has heard today, a much more significant risk to our communities, our firefighters, and our forests than prescribed fire does. And we don't have to look too far to see what those impacts are. We could look back last fall to Northern California, where 44 people were killed and 8,000 homes were lost. We can look to our neighbors to the north, and just, you know, one county, the largest county in Washington, over 2 years in 2014 and 15, 20% of that largest county in Washington burned, and those communities, I was just up there a couple weeks ago, still recovering from those wildfires. Closer to home, as Pete alluded to, 50% of the Sisters Ranger District has been burned since 2002, which has forced the evacuation of 6,000 homes and the loss of 20 residences. And I could go on and on with the stats in that regard that I think you're probably aware of. But with that in mind, the risk that wildfire poses, it's really been hard to reconcile the fact that the smoke management plan doesn't seem to fully take into consideration or weigh the risk, fully weigh the risk that wildfire poses to our communities. I will acknowledge I do believe the rules as proposed are moving in the right direction, but I don't think that they go quite far enough. As a local government, Deschutes County really has to take a more holistic view of both smoke and wildfire risk to our vulnerable populations, and not just look at the smoke that we can regulate through prescribed fire rules. So I do support the proposed compliance with the Clean Air Act and even the 75% buffer off of the NAAQS to provide that safety zone for us to not provide NAAQS exceedances based on that 24-hour average standard. However, the one-hour standard really hasn't been justified by any sort of scientific study, and I think that it'll unduly impact our ability to reduce our risk to vulnerable populations and communities. I'd also suggest that this isn't just a Bend or Deschutes County problem. I think we may be on the leading edge of this issue. We've got a lot of units that are pending that have been through the planning process and that are funded. But I would submit that based on the wide geography of people that have been concerned about this issue, that you're going to see other people have problems with trying to implement burns close to communities, and that's what we're really talking about is this one-hour standard and how that runs right up against trying to put fire on the ground next to those communities to provide a buffer zone for a wildfire. So I'd ask you to please reconsider the inclusion of the one-hour standard in the draft rule revisions. I think it's fine to trigger some kind of public warning system, and in fact, I would say that we've been in the process of implementing a local communication strategy in Central Oregon. We just have deployed a website just this week that talks about smoke and public health that people can go to for information. So I really do place a value on letting people know how they can protect themselves. I think the one-hour standard is fine for triggering a communication plan, but I would ask that it not be used to regulate burning so that we can get this burning done close to our communities and provide that protection. Thank you.
Thank you. Next is slightly unusual. Two members of the Smoke Management Review Committee who could not be here today have submitted testimony and would like to have that read into the record. And so with the board's indulgence, we'll have Chad Davis perform that function.
Good morning.
You might have a future in Audible books or something.
Well, that's to be determined. Yes, for the record, this is the voice of Chad Davis, Department of Forestry employee. I am reading into the record. two partners, two folks that I consider partners, testimony here today. The first is from John Stromberg, who is the mayor of the city of Ashland. State Forester, Chair Imeson, and members of the board, the proposal before you is not a recommendation from the Smoke Management Review Committee, as called for in the Smoke Management Review Committee's charter. It is kind of a final offer in negotiations between staff and the majority of the Smoke Management Review Committee members, while both sides were attempting to bridge a deep divide over the focus and impact of Oregon's regulation of controlled burning. The staff proposal makes several important steps away from the existing policy, which is essentially to keep all smoke from controlled burning out of smoke-sensitive receptive areas. At the same time, it is primarily concerned with protecting the public from both long-term and short-term exposure to controlled burning smoke. On the other hand, the controlled burner side of this issue has not been represented as well as it should in the current proposal, and I would like to lay out that line of reasoning and facts for you now. But first, we need to consider some important developments in the context in which the smoke management regulation is now taking place and will increasingly take place. The first contextual issue is the increased occurrence of wildfires in the West and Northwest, including California. This is coupled with the fact that numerous cities have built out into and near their adjacent forests. And this is coupled with climate change and its consequent lengthening of the warm weather season, increased droughts, higher temperatures, etc., all of which increase the danger to communities of the type of unstoppable wildfire that devastated parts of Santa Rosa last summer and 7 years ago burned 11 houses in a row in 45 minutes in the town of Ashland. Increased wildfires also mean more wildfire smoke, which can accumulate in communities far from the fires themselves, as was experienced in Portland, the San Francisco Bay Area, and the Rogue Valley last summer. Also, part of the context for today's discussion is the emergence of restoration forestry used for the dual purposes of protecting communities from the direct threat of fire in adjacent forests and to prevent wildfires in general with their wide-spreading, far-traveling smoke. Restoration forestry refers to removing by mechanical means excess fuel that has built up in forests due to widespread suppression of fires and over the past 100 years or so. Once this arduous and expensive process has been completed, the thin forests are much more resilient and resistant to wildfire. And the natural process of keeping fuel levels low can be resumed via controlled burning. One last data point. According to wildfire experts, the number of trees currently in our forest is 3 times what it was before the practice of wildfire suppression was instituted. To put a point on it from my particular situation, Ashland, with its closely packed old wooden houses and abundant foliage, could be swept away in one hot, dry, windy day in a fire touched off by ignitions in our watershed from newly grown fuel that has returned after being mechanically removed and which we haven't been able to remove with controlled burning because of the smoke management. Into this unresolved dilemma, the staff proposal in good faith extends an optimistic proposition. We will hold you to 74% of the NAC's 24-hour average and or 70% of the top of the moderate category on the AQI, the 1-hour average, whichever you hit first. They point out that this opens up 80% of the previously restricted opportunities for controlled burning, and they also offer a different approach to optimizing burning opportunities even within the existing system. The controlled burners are encouraged by this 24-hour standard, and then feel the 1-hour standard takes away most of what the 24-hour standard opens up, especially in those crucial burns that must take place close to the borders of the inhibited smoke-sensitive receptor areas. They also counter that there is no scientific research offered to substantiate the 1-hour standard, that the staff proposal doesn't mention that smoke from wildfires themselves is exempted from regulation by the EPA, while controlled burns both protect smoke-sensitive receptor area communities and from the direct threat of the fire, but also reduce the likelihood of wildfire smoke wherever it might migrate. And lastly, that every minute we discuss this subject, in every restoration forestry wildfire prevention project, new fuels are relentlessly replacing fuel removed by mechanical thinning, undoing years of work and the expenditure of tens of millions of dollars. Lastly, on the controlled burners side of the discussion, is the fact that communities have begun deploying smoke mitigation programs. Ashlands was presented to a subcommittee of the Oregon House 2 weeks ago. These programs inform citizens of ways they can protect themselves from what may be a future of unpredictable bouts of wildfire smoke. Ashland's first phase was begun, and the second phase we are now planning is intended to provide real-time, geographic-specific, AQI-calibrated information to our smoke-vulnerable population. With this background, I would characterize the decision before you today as how to bring together the world of public health, environmental protection, and respiratory health NGOs with the world of wildfire prevention and wildfire smoke reduction projects, such as those in Deschutes County, Northeast Oregon, and Ashland, and practical measures that will move us forward to meeting what we all acknowledge are important goals on both sides. Also, with high stakes, both social and political, on both sides, our pioneering restoration project continually being unraveled because of restrictions on controlled burning. My suggestion is to approve the staff proposal without the one-hour standard provisionally for 18 months, and then administratively within the Department of Forestry, establish working groups of staff and restoration practitioners to, one, explore the possibilities in actual controlled burning burns for increasing the number of acres of controlled burning within this new framework, two, use adaptive management versus punitive regulation to avoid NACS violations, learn how to minimize necessary violations of the one-hour standard, three, discuss with the EPA getting exemptions to the NACS as wildfire itself is not exempted for controlled burning that must take place close to or within smoke-sensitive receptive areas because of their extreme vulnerability to wildfire. Four, develop and track smoke mitigation measures aimed at smoke-vulnerable individuals. Five, report monthly through the coming fall, that'd be 2018, and the spring of 2019, controlled burning seasons, and reconvene the Smoke Management Review Committee in the spring of 19 to resolve contested issues for which we will now have shared experiences plus actual data to help evolve the smoke management regulation to meet the needs of our current and future circumstances. Thanks for your consideration, John Stromberg, Mayor of the City of Ashland. If you ask me questions, I will plead the fifth. Okay, now second testimony to be read into record is from Mark Webb, who is the Executive Director of the Blue Mountain Forest Partners. This is a collaborative group on the north end of the Mount Hare National Forest. Dear Board of Forestry members, thank you for the opportunity to provide public testimony regarding ODS rulemaking process. As you move forward with this effort, I encourage you and the EQC to seriously reevaluate the merit of using the one-hour threshold to define smoke intrusions. I say this for three reasons. First, the majority of the Smoke Management Review Committee members did not support using the one-hour threshold to define smoke intrusions. Second, the proposed one-hour threshold was included based on the unsubstantiated belief that the 24-hour NACS does not adequately protect human health. The mistaken belief that prescribed fire smoke and wildfire smoke are qualitatively similar and impact human health the same way, and the mistaken belief that implementing mechanical treatments and prescribed fire at larger scales fails to mitigate wildfire behavior and smoke. I appreciate that public policy decisions frequently go beyond what science might say about a matter. However, I also know that it's irresponsible to ignore credible, relevant science when one is formulating public policy. Unfortunately, that happened when the decision was made to use the one-hour threshold to define smoke intrusions. And it's arguably the primary reason many committee members were uncomfortable including it in the proposal before you. Third, the one-hour threshold implemented without exception, regardless of landscape type or community need, will significantly compromise efforts to effectively treat high-risk, high-priority areas around communities in Oregon's fire-adapted landscape. As wildfire smoke and wildfires constitute air pollution and pollution sources per ORS 468A.005, the one-hour threshold will thus compromise Oregon's broader responsibility to safeguard the air resources of the state for the overall public welfare of the state, as required by ORS 468.015 and ORS 468A.010. Sincerely, Mark Webb, Executive Director, Blue Mountain Forest Partners.
Thanks. So, Michael and Doug, do you want to come back up? And I'll check first with Cindy to see if you have any questions to start with.
So I do have at least one question. A number of the folks, either that had their testimony read in or that provided testimony, talked about the lack of scientific basis for the one-hour standard. Any response to that?
Sure. Commissioner Williams, this is Michael Orman from DEQ. I think that, in discussions with OHA and some of the air advocates that were part of the committee that we brought together to review the smoke management plan, we discussed one-hour health impacts or short-term health impacts and the science behind those. And we had difficulty tracking down specific research that would suggest a specific level like we have for the NACs, where there's a trigger above a certain level, you expect health impacts. So that's an accurate statement from some of the commenters that you received. What we also acknowledged is that, people don't breathe over a 24-hour average, and that there are one-hour impacts or short-term impacts that will cause adverse health outcomes. And so we felt that it was important for us to set a short-term threshold where we would take a closer look at a specific burn and look for mitigation at strategies to further reduce smoke for those specific burns. And as you heard from commenters, as we get closer to communities, we're going to see more opportunities for evaluating different strategies. And so we felt like a one-hour threshold met that outcome that we were looking for.
Thanks. No questions?
Then, if I can
continue, keep going.
There was also discussion that most of the times that a smoke intrusion would exceed the proposed one-hour standard occur at night. Presumably, could you comment on the fact of the relative health risks associated to nighttime intrusion versus daytime intrusion?
Sure, Commissioner Williams, this is Michael Erman again. I would add that I think that the specific impacts on a short-term basis depend on the location where the burns are occurring. Some might happen during the evening, others may happen during the day. It just depends on the specific location and where those burns are occurring. I'm looking to Doug to see if he wants to add more, but that being said, the specific impacts would depend also on communications with the community and how effective those are, whether windows are closed and at night if someone has windows open, especially during the evening. It depends on the type of exposure and the length of exposure on what kind of impacts you would see.
Thank you.
Board Member Williams, Doug Graff here. I would also suggest those are really very good questions for Oregon Health Authority. They were the expert in the room in the conversation in terms of agencies on the health effects at the 1 hour. And I'm not at the table today. But those are very good questions for clarity for the board to understand through response to Oregon Health Authority.
Great. So now a comment just to other board members. It appears to me, at least, that what we're needing to do is weigh the relative risk of short-term smoke intrusions from prescribed fire versus the risk of long-term smoke intrusion from wildfire. And we're also dealing in a situation where we are in an environment of increasing climate change impacts that are likely to be increasing the risks of smoke intrusion from wildfire. For comparison, to the proposed one-hour standard, last summer in the Ashland area, we had 4 weeks, not hours, 4 weeks of continuous smoke intrusion from wildfire that registered at least moderate, and several days were actually way past unhealthy to sensitive groups and up into the hazardous range. From some of the previous discussions that came from the Bend area, I can only echo that in the Rogue Valley, and specifically in the Ashland area, we're in a similar geographical airflow situation where the smoke from prescribed fire does drift down into the city, early morning hours, when most people are asleep. If you're trying to burn some of those particularly important high-risk areas close to the urban interface, the city has invested millions of dollars on thinning and fuel reduction, which they are unable to maintain without the ability to do prescribed fire. Because of existing smoke management rules, they have not been able to burn to the extent that we want to. And you may all recall last year when we were on the field tour, some fairly extensive discussions and information provided on that point. So for what it's worth, I am inclined to either propose that we proceed with the smoke management rules without the one-hour rule standard entirely, or with the addition of an exemption process that is available to those communities that have substantial smoke mitigation programs that include notification to citizens and other elements like what we see in the Ashland watershed. We've got a fairly extensive smoke notification process so that not only can people get information online, they can subscribe to an email or text alert process. They can call in by phone. And the city is currently even exploring opportunities to provide smoke refuge sites to folks in the community that can't get away from it, much like they have winter warming stations or summer cooling stations. Risking a one-hour smoke intrusion at the moderate level when you are still meeting not only the national air quality standard, but meeting it with a 25% buffer seems like a fair trade-off for the possibility of reducing smoke intrusions from wildfire.
I guess I'd like to pursue that a little bit. The alternative B proposal that Mark Stern provided, something like that is attractive to me because I think we do see communities who are really doing a lot of work around this issue, and providing some mechanism for them I think that this would need to be fleshed out during the rulemaking process, but where they are taking the appropriate steps sort of beyond what we currently have in terms of communication and mitigation and those kinds of things, to be able to, obviously Ashland is one of those, with the mayor's testimony, that would seem to, as engaged as they've been with the Ashland watershed and the prescribed burning and the other kinds of things they've been doing to mitigate risk in that area, to provide some avenue. And I guess I'd ask for your reaction to that.
Sure. And I'd like to speak to vulnerable populations. This came up at the fire summit. Older homes are not smoke safe. They are built to standards where closing the windows do not protect you, and particularly older homes in low-income areas. And so, I'm open to the idea of an exception, but I think we really need to focus on the vulnerable population. We've seen time and time again, if we're really willing to focus on vulnerable populations, we help everyone. And so I'm open for it, but I think we need more than just notification. We need real mitigation, and particularly for low-income folks, because closing the windows doesn't help. There, I think it came up at the Fire Summit that inexpensive, you can make one room safe with very inexpensive things. So this, the way it would benefit everybody is if you start doing this, then we're not doing anything during those wildfire intrusions where we have 2 weeks. These people would also be protected during the wildfire events. And I would be surprised if anybody in this room really thinks we're going to stop wildfire smoke in the short term with an increase in prescribed fire. There's going to be a lag time. So we're actually talking about increasing smoke overall in these communities. So I'm open to it, but I think that the board needs to make it needs to be stronger than just communication is mitigation.
And I mentioned mitigation purposely.
So if I can comment in here, Ashland is doing more than just notification and communication.
Right.
They have actually put together a fairly elaborate program, not just on notification when there's smoke, but education about what you do to limit your exposure when there is smoke, whether it's from a prescribed fire or from a wildfire. And like I said, they're also starting to look at options to deal with homeless communities and people within the homeless population that don't have a house to retreat to and are looking at setting up sort of a smoke-safe area like they do for winter warming and summer cooling. So clearly we have to be concerned about vulnerable populations, but it seems to me like we're so worried about some short-term risk to a few people from prescribed fire smoke that we are not doing everything we need to address the greater long-term risk of smoke from wildfire that, frankly, in my perspective, you're right, we're not going to deal with immediately, but we better get started on it or it's going to overwhelm even people that are not unhealthy or sensitive in the near future, too.
Just in reaction to your point, Peter, one, I do want to acknowledge, so we don't have, I guess, stakeholders from the other side to provide added context today, so I recognize that. I also appreciate thinking about, you know, the especially less fortunate in the population that have less ability to respond to these types of things. I still fall back to two things. So one, I'm very supportive of moving forward with either the exemption or, quite candidly, I'd be supportive of eliminating the 1 hour. And my basis is, again, testimony suggesting there is no science that supports the 1 hour. I mean, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to recognize we don't breathe in 24-hour segments. I completely understand that too. But it seems to me we're leaning to the extremely conservative side of things there. And if there was not the offsetting impact of wildfires, you know, that we're trying to offset that, and that does take time, I wouldn't lean so much towards actually even supporting eliminating the 1 hour, but that I see this as we're trying to shift that in the long term. It's going to be beneficial. And why would we take the conservative approach, where there's no science to support that? But I'd be open to different aspects. I don't know that we can dictate, well, I guess we can say mitigating factors. What does that mean? Of course, dictating, that communities put in air purifiers or those types of things. I'm not sure that's our role, but.
Yeah, and I think a lot of this would have to be fleshed out of the rulemaking process, but I guess I listened earlier today to the EQC meeting in May where Doug and Michael presented, and so did Oregon Health Authority, and you know, these are not, and I have a also somewhat of a pragmatic side in wanting to get through the process so that we have something that's effective sooner rather than later. And these are issues of real concern for folks coming at it from the air quality perspective. And I'm personally more comfortable. In fact, I really like the idea of having communities get more engaged in what they need to do to help address these issues from a health perspective. And are on their own, and I would say, local elected officials are on their own having to weigh those concerns of health versus smoke management. And I think that's really would be a positive outcome from all of this to have them engaged in understanding impacts and weigh the issues the way that actually the state has to weigh those issues through EQC, through Board of Forestry, through the Health Authority as well. It seems like a really positive dynamic to me to have that occur.
I've got a question for the other board members. Have you all seen do you have in front of you the proposed language that I believe Nature Conservancy developed to add a section C on page 19 that talks about providing this alternative approach.
That's what I was, Cindy, that's what I was talking about is that language. But I think during rulemaking, there are lots of things around this that would have to be, who would approve it, who would propose it, those kinds of things. So.
I'd be very comfortable with including that language in the proposed rulemaking process that we're going out to the public with and using the public process to flesh out some of those questions, but starting with that paragraph C included.
And at some point, go ahead and Nils.
Certainly listening to today's testimony and acknowledging my own biases in this and just my own concern about forest conditions and the fact that we will be living with more fire and more smoke in the future no matter what we do. And I think it's important we try to get ahead of that with effective fuel reduction treatments. Including a much stronger prescribed burning program. I'm clearly looking for more latitude to do more prescribed burning. And with that, all of that, I'm in agreement with Tom in that and part of me really would love to see alternative A just remove the 1 hour limit. At the same time, I appreciate what both Toms have said, that there's many important stakeholders that help build the case for the one-hour limit over the course of the work of the smoke management review, and they're not really here to continue to advocate for that. And as Peter alluded to, there were many other experts at the OSU Fire Summit that spoke in with a lot of science and experience behind them of the effects of shorter duration smoke on vulnerable populations. So with all that being said, I very much support the alternative B that TNC presented and agree that we could probably improve on that language, but that's a great starting point to ensure that there's an opportunity for exemptions. But I also agree with Peter that it should be more than just a communication plan. And while you may not want to, legislate that a town or a community has to buy air purifiers, you could put incentives in or put programs in place to do that. We talked about at the OSU Fire Summit that groups like Community Connections that already provide winter energy assistance for low-income homes or other vulnerable populations could have a program to help provide air purifiers, for the summer. there's different ways to try to get around that, and that that should be designed and put in place in addition to the communications.
So
the other thing that I particularly like about putting in something, like we're talking about with this community communication and mitigation plan relative to prescribed fire, is that those vulnerable populations are also vulnerable to the smoke from wildfire. And if we have a public education and mitigation program in place for the smoke from prescribed fire, it is likely that the sensitive populations will also benefit with respect to the smoke from wildfire as a result of that program.
Response?
Yes, please.
I'm beginning to hear coalescing around a recommendation to add language C as proposed. And I'll read it, because I don't know that it's in everyone's hands today. Communities that develop and implement such a plan to proactively alert the public of likely prescribed fire smoke impacts and provide actions to mitigate exposure will be granted an exemption from the one-hour smoke intrusion threshold in order to provide maximum opportunity for essential burning in the wildland-urban interface where wildfire risk to forest communities and firefighters is greatest. I've also heard approval questions around the governing body that can approve that exception. I've heard mitigation language to be added to that. I would also suggest DEQ and ODF involvement in where's the administrative process to say here's your exception to the 1 hour and include some monitoring components. This is all embodied in the language 048-0180 right below communication plan. So that language suggests you have a communication plan. If you have a robust communication plan with those components approved through local body, EQ, ODF, then you get an exemption for 1 hour. If that's the will of the board, we would add that as part of the public hearing process where we could bring in the interested parties who are not at the table, and I listed those before because they would certainly would have an interest in the conversation. And based on my observations from the efforts of the advisory committee, I think this is something we could talk about with those groups because it really reinforces the engagement of local communities, which will be necessary for successful implementation of this overall program. So I think so, that would be a great assessment.
Yeah, that's fair, yeah.
Doug, as you're getting the through the public process, I'd encourage you also to consider and discuss the other elements that were in Mayor Stromberg's testimony. I don't think we want to go with the 18 months administratively, but he looked at, talked about sort of tracking and reporting the results of smoke intrusions from controlled burning sessions and using that for development of shared experience over the coming year.
Absolutely.
For instance.
Well, I think that's kind of putting monitoring and an adaptation in the exception process would ensure that.
A question is, if we are going to amend the recommendation before us with this language or language like this, do we need to, is there anything we need to do to clarify this at this point, or
staff presented a proposal absent of that language, so I think appreciate some direction from the board to include that language.
Yeah.
To
yes. No, I'm just asking about the language.
I move that we include the proposed language C from the Nature Conservancy testimony.
Yeah, and I was asking whether staff is recommending any modification of that language, or is this good enough to get this the conversation started?
I think this
is good enough. Sorry, you were breaking up a little bit, so I couldn't quite tell.
Okay.
I think we're comfortable with moving forward with what we've heard in terms of vetting that through the public hearing process, which is exactly what that's meant to do.
Right. So can I interpret your motion, Cindy, as a motion to amend the staff recommendation by the addition of that new language, C, in that item?
Yes, that sounds good.
Okay, is there a second to that motion?
We get a question after that or not?
Yeah, then you get to ask all the questions you want.
Second.
Just trying to, then that's what we're talking about. Okay, there's second. Moved and seconded.
I just want to make sure from what I understood from the exchange between, Chairman Iveson and Director Graff that when it goes through this public hearing process, the other issues that we raised around mitigation and monitoring, et cetera, might be integrated in some final language there. Because that wasn't
well. The mitigate exposure is in here.
Okay,
but it says described above, which is I think mostly communication.
Yeah.
So maybe if we strike out as described above,
as long as yeah. I mean, as long yeah. as we think that some of these other issues that have been brought up here will be added into your review with the other stakeholders, I'm totally fine with that. I don't know that we need to wordsmith it all right here. Yeah.
You could even say including those described above if you wanted to. With
agreed.
Including but not limited okay. to. The lawyer and me,
agree,
I'm not a lawyer.
Okay. Great.
And I'm not the director.
Okay, so I'm not a lawyer either, so. All right, so we have the language as Cindy proposed it. It's been seconded. Any further discussion? Okay, then all those in favor of that amendment, please say aye.
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 And now the aye. Issue goes to the staff recommendation as amended. So they have a motion on that. In other words, we've just adopted the change. Now we need to adopt the whole thing.
So moved.
Moved.
Second.
Tom Insko seconds. Any further discussion? Then all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed?
Aye.
Motion carries. Thank you. And thank you guys for your work on this, and to all those who appeared today. I think this is a really good constructive effort. We appreciate it.
We're going to try to push through.
Yeah, we don't say push through, Peter.